7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Happy Sunday, Croc Nation. Dr. Tommy and Ellie here with another Croc podcast for you deserving awesome survivors. Angel Santana, have faith, let it begin. On the other side of the computer glass, Angel, how you doing?
Well, I would like to say happy October to you and all of the Croc Podcast Nation. I am doing very well.
Fantastic. And, you know, you bring up a good point. We're rounding the last curve, right, of the last quarter of the fiscal year. And boy, I'll tell you, this year certainly flew.
Without a doubt. I blink and I can't figure out where the time has gone.
So we should be coming upon our 100th podcast soon, I would think.
We are very close, extremely close.
We should have like a little celebration and invite all of the survivors over to the house and like have a cookout with hot dogs.
Hey, listen, I'm down. Fire pit, you name it. Let's go.
So as we discussed last week, we're kind of moving to a different format. We're becoming a little more informal, which is in line with our whole philosophy. And one of the things that we had been doing in our modules is if there was a learning or teaching moment or a moment where I came across a situation at work that I thought might be worthy of discussion and help our survivors get through their survivorship and their journey, to share it, again, to be transparent and not looking to hide anything, not looking to, at all try to put ourselves as perfect. We all make mistakes. And I came across a situation a few weeks ago that I thought would be a really great podcast. And I'm calling this podcast, A Time to Be Funny and A Time to Be Serious.
Yeah, I agree. There's always a time for, to be humorous, as you pointed out, and a good time to, take it to not the level of seriousness, but to be understood and understanding.
Yeah. And I think that whole thing about the whole Croc experience, the whole Croc organization, the whole Croc, the decades and how we've grown and the services we've offered our survivors over the year, although have changed, there have been several points or pillars, as we call them, our foundational pillars. And they are to remind our survivors to engender informality, to encourage approachability, to disseminate information and to demand accessibility. And we do that. And a lot of that is just my personality and how I come across wearing the jerseys and trying to get to know the essence of each of our patients and trying to inject humor in difficult situations in order to try to disarm them or try to make them feel less sad or try to get them back on in a positive way. And that's kind of our I don't even want to say our motto, or that's our war cry, I would say, that way of approaching things. And I just happened to do a consult yesterday with a guy who had very similar upbringing. He was an Italian immigrant from an Italian immigrant family, and he grew up in Trenton rather than Patterson, grew up in a blue collar family, the whole thing. And we had an hour. We didn't even talk about medicine. We talked about everything, and we were both talking so much that you couldn't even get a word in, and we were kept on interrupting each other and slapping each other's back, having fun and laughing. And that's the way you want it to go, and that's the way you hope it goes, because when he left, he really had no concerns about his treatment, he had no concerns about his outcome, he had no concerns about life in general. But then in other cases, that doesn't happen all the time. And some people that just doesn't fit. And that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today.
Absolutely. And the great thing about our show too, is, we're not actors. We're not even trained podcasters. We are two individuals with a mission. And of course, our goal is that, if we can change one person's life, doing that by one episode, then we've done our job.
Exactly. And to get into the story. So, Angel, before we started this podcast, I'll let everyone in kind of behind the scenes. You were on a roll. You were, doing a little bit of a skit for me, and it was so funny. And, Sometimes you just have it, right? Like even in a room, sometimes just the words are coming and somebody will say something and I'll retort like it's a straight line and I'll retort with a funny retort. And, you feel like you're on or you're on fire. And I guess comedians must feel that when they're doing routines where sometimes they bomb and sometimes they're really, just straight up. And I happened to be in a room with a woman that I had been taking care of for a while. Now, the circumstances were very serious. I talked about that gentleman I saw yesterday. Not that his cancer was not serious, but this particular circumstance with this woman was serious. And she had, and I knew her, and she knew me, and she knew about my shtick and the humor. And we had the navigator Janie in there with us, and she was there with her son. And her son basically sat there with basically completely like rock face, just basically like he was a statue. And here I am doing my thing, and I'm kind of oblivious to the body language and the energy that he was portraying in this particular encounter. And there was tenseness that I didn't really pick up on. And I didn't read the room. I didn't, I knew her, and I was hot, and I was really, making analogies. And I think I even got a Batman analogy going in there, and I thought it was perfect. And I'm thinking I'm doing great. And as I leave the room, did you ever leave a situation and everyone thinks you're out of earshot, but you're really not? And then people start talking and they say things you really shouldn't hear. But you do, and that's exactly what happened. And he went off, he just went crazy. And he didn't know I was listening, but he was not happy at all. And I think that the way he, took it was that here I was like this clown who didn't really, didn't, this is his mom, this is he's not this is serious, and he's not taking, his mother's case like he thinks this is a joke. And he had a couple of choice words, juiced up with some really good, F-bombs. And it was hard to take, I have to tell you. And I wanted to go in there. And, basically, I didn't know whether I wanted to go in there and beat the crap out of him or go in there and like just like go on my knees and apologize, And as I to what I did was I just decided not to confront him. And I just kind of left with my tail between my legs. And think about it. And I knew I was going to bring it to the podcast. And I think that it was a really great moment for me because, those types of moments where you really get stung, they force you to take stock. They force you to, think about, your philosophy, your thought processes, the way you do things, and kind of reevaluate and make adjustments. And it was really painful, but it was a great learning moment for me, and I think a really great teaching moment for the survivors.
Yeah, it's tough. There's, you're when we are used to doing something that we are very good at naturally, we're in an environment where we feel like we're in control of it. And sometimes we get into this routine to the point where we are not aware of our overall environment. And I can sympathize with you. I had an incident where I would actually facilitate a lot of the call outs. And I would send them to the nursing supervisors in charge. Well, some of the nursing supervisors and I have we try to find the positive and the negative. So when I would call, I go, well, we've got a contestant number one on caller number two. Well, I ended up doing that, and one of the people said, well, this is not a game. People are calling out. We're understaffed. And I says, I know, I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to be that, making a joke out of this. I was just trying to make light of the fact that yes, there are a lot of callouts. So I can sympathize with you on that aspect as well. But it's a tough pill to swallow too.
Yeah, it is. And there was another case actually a couple of weeks ago where the person that was coming in, I actually knew her husband was a colleague, and I had was given the heads up that like she was like super duper nervous and didn't want to even talk about her diagnosis and the whole thing. And I went in there and I was like perfect. I mean, I was just straight up, I was exactly what needed to be, for that particular patient, but I was given a heads up. In this other case, I wasn't given a heads up, but I want to, talk about that because I think we should still be able to give our survivors what they deserve. So there are four things, in my opinion, that they deserve from us as their caregivers. I believe they deserve a safe environment. I believe they deserve a comfortable environment. I believe they deserve a trusting environment. And I believe they deserve a respectful environment. And how do we provide these four pillars for a successful therapeutic dyad? And I think that the first step is to know the case cold. So that I already do. So I already read the charts early in the morning. I know everything about every patient. And then before I go in, I review them again and I go through the films and the whole thing and talk to whoever I have to talk to. So when I walk in there, I'm ready for the test. So that's number one. Number two is get to know the players. So in this case, I did have an established patient, but I didn't have a relationship with her son. There's a difference also between an established patient and a patient that you're just meeting for the first time. Then you also have to know the difference of the circumstances. You can know if a room is happy or a room is sad. Sometimes the news is good. Sometimes the news is bad. Sometimes the diagnosis is, awful. It's always awful, right? But sometimes it's not as awful as it can be. And sometimes it's super awful. And you have to know the difference and know whether or not you're walking into a room that's super sad or, not as sad. And you also have to know if you're in unknown territory, meaning that if you don't know what's going on or really can't really read the room, rather than going and being yourself. So again, me being the person that I generally am, me being the person, the Croc podcaster, the Croc organization, founder and chief operating officer and bottle washer and the whole thing. That's my way, but I could also be a different way, meaning I don't always have to be that way. I can also alter myself to fit the circumstance and always on the side of being conservative. So if you don't know the situation, reduce the humor, increase the empathy, and increase your listening. And I think that's a good first step.
Absolutely. I have a question since we're still on this topic. As the doctor, is it safe to say that, just because you have an established patient, and they know who you are and you've had a good rapport with them, that doesn't also necessarily mean that on your second or third visit, even though you've had that rapport, that interaction could be different because you don't know what they're coming in with. So that's kind of hard to stay with that pattern because you don't really know what kind of patient you're going to get if they've seen you three times. It could be a bad day. And you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I will say though, to not to disagree with you, because I really do think that point is excellent. But for instance, in this particular instance, I didn't call the son, but I did call the patient and I apologized profusely. And she started laughing. She said, "Please, you are fine. I know exactly who you are and you are exactly who I wanted you to be. My son, he has no sense of humor and blah, 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 blah. It's on him." But I didn't feel that way. I thought he deserved, to get what he felt would have been one of these four things that I didn't provide: either a safe environment, a comfortable environment, a trusting environment, or respect. Probably in his case, it would be more of a respectful environment. So let's talk about that for a second. Let's talk about those four pillars. So safety can be many things. A person can be made to feel safe by being with someone that they trust or that they feel secure with. But in a patient's case, when they come to see a doctor, believe it or not, waiting 3 hours does not make you feel safe. You want to make sure that their waiting time is, they're not in the waiting area or sitting in a room in a gown for 2 hours because the stress level becomes very high and you're afraid. So if you're afraid, just by definition of fear, you don't feel safe, right? Also, you want to be able to empathize with the patient. You want to make sure that you can put yourself in their shoes as close as you possibly can. You can't walk in their shoes directly, but you can try to to achieve that empathy. And I think that that will also create a safety, a feeling of safety for the patient. And going back to the same point I've made several times, know the case. If the patient goes in and they know that you know them, and not just know them as a person, but know their case cold and know that they just had an x-ray the other day. As I told you, this year was the year of the cardiologist, and I went in the first time and he was awesome. And, you know, we're going to do this, this, and this, and we're going to check you out and blah, blah, blah. And when I came in the second time, he had no idea who I was. He had no idea why I was there. He had no idea anything about my case. And I didn't feel safe at all. I felt like, you know, well, why am I here? Like, okay. I said, I'm here because you told me to come back with these things. And he goes, oh, yeah. Okay. Well, this is good then. This is all good. Okay. Then I said, well, then you were going to tell me if you were going to do any further testing. He goes, oh, okay. Yeah. No, you don't need any further testing. Like, I left there. I felt like it was a complete waste of time. It was a complete awful experience. And I didn't feel safe. You also want to be comfortable. So, Angel, if you walk in a doctor's office, what is the biggest turnoff besides, as we said, waiting for 3 hours? What would turn you off the most?
When I walk into, you know what? If I see a stack of magazines.
That turns you off. How about if you see a dirty office?
Oh, well, listen, that's a given. But I mean, the first thing I look at is if there's
It's actually not a given. I'm shocked when I go into doctors myself or even go into different departments or whatever. I mean, it's shocking that many doctors' offices are not clean.
I agree. Well, I think what I mean is when I walk in, I always look to the counter. If I see there's a ton of magazines or if I see there's somebody there waiting with magazines, I'm going to wait. Now, then I pick up a magazine, I sit down, and then I start looking at the environment. I look around and I peruse. And if I see it that it's not clean, or that's when I get a little worried.
And I have to tell you that they should have a course in medical school on decorating, because I seldom, except for a plastic surgeon I went to once, that's another story for another day. But like, you know, besides that guy who had a very nice office, like we basically, what do? We go on Tuesday night, junk night with a truck and like pick up whatever furniture people put out? Is that where we get our little tables? Is that where we get our chairs? You think of a more uncomfortable chair than in a doctor's waiting room. And like, if they do have a TV, it's like about 2 inches and it's on a terrible channel. You know, sometimes I'll have Dr. Pimple Popper up on the TV. Like, we don't want to see Dr. Pimple Pumper, you know, Pimple Popper up there. We don't feel comfortable, you know. Another thing in our teaching hospital, we're full of residents and students and training nurses and navigators. You know, that's kind of, I mean, what are you going to say if they say, oh, do you mind if 100 people come and, you know, do your consult with us? I mean, what are you going to say? You can say no, but then you look like a jerk. So, you know, of course you're going to say yes, but you're not going to feel comfortable. And then the other thing is the temperature of the room. I mean, how many times have you gone into a room and it's freezing or it's too hot? And then God bless my mother, God rest her soul. She used to always complain because she was a very big woman, and she would go into these rooms and they would have her put on these paper gowns that didn't fit. And she would say she's like, you know, hanging out all over the place. And my mom was very busty and, you know, a poor lady. She probably, if I was her, I would feel like, oh my God, you couldn't, like, you might as well just throw me in the middle of, you know, the Colosseum, you know, with 800,000 people and just let me walk out there naked, you know. That's the way she probably felt. And I will say, since this is a podcast about mistakes, I will give myself credit that I have never worked in an office where I didn't have super big gowns for my bigger survivor. So I will say thank you to my mom on that. Trusting environment. You have to be honest always. If you're an oncologist, it's part of the job to give bad news. It's just the way it is. It's not always going to be. And the majority of my day is like, oh, you're doing great. Your PET scan's perfect. Everything went away. You're good. You have no evidence of disease. But it's not going to be every time. You're not going to be able to say that every time. The secret is to create that trust. You can be honest. You have to be honest. But you have to know how to give bad news. You have to, first of all, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, giving bad news. First of all, letting your secretary give bad news. doing it over the telephone, not doing it face to face, and not really caring or not giving enough time to let the patient evaluate and go through the process of those, you know, that emotional process when you do give that bad news. And you have to be a teacher. You know, physicians are really teachers. And when we go in there and we talk to patients, they're going to feel a lot of trust in you if you teach and you're not just telling them or lecturing to them, but you're teaching them and you make them part of the conversation. And we did a module on shared decision-making where not only are you not telling them what to do, you're including them in the process and helping them formulate the plan with you. You become a partner rather than a dictator. And you have to be transparent. You always have to be truthful, never hide anything, and tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God. And I think that those things will help create that trusting environment. And lastly, the respectful environment, which I didn't probably achieve with this son, you have to be a great listener. So sometimes I have to learn just to shut up and just give them space. You have to have eye contact. Remember, we had a podcast about the computer and how the computer and the electronic medical record distracts you from, you know, giving your full attention and respect to the patient. And I think those things together, remember on the Croc podcast for our survivors, you know, we point out problems, but we don't just point out these problems. We try to come up with solutions. And I believe by addressing these four pillars and being able to read the room and err on the sense of conservative behavior and being a different, you could be a different person, a different doctor, or have a different position or a different sort of aura about you, depending on what the environment and the experience requires. And I think that if you do all of those things, you'll be shocked that you will achieve a room that will lighten up that thick tension, that wall of tension, that curtain of tension will just drop, and your connectivity with the patient and the will increase, and you'll strengthen your relationship with them. And then, you know, if it's appropriate, you can interject your humor and then bring them up. Or if it's a situation where humor has to be the first pillar, then that's what you do. But you have to be able to read the room and know when it's time to be funny and when it's time to be serious. Angel Santana.
I agree. And, you know, I would like to invite all of the Croc Nation to go back to one of our first episodes called The Waiting Room. I think this is a great time for us to let you know that, you know, that's how we started. And it has a similar relation to this. I would like to point out that I think that what we talked about today is so important. You know, you brought back a memory just now that I don't think I've ever really shared with anyone. You know, when I had my spinal surgery, it was in Albany Medical Center, and it's a teaching school. And here I am at 18 years of age. And the first time they came in, there was about seven people. And I was a little bit, you know, nervous, but I got really nervous because they were very, very attractive young ladies. And, you know, and the doctor noticed that I had blushed. So the very next day when they came back, the doctor came in by himself and said, "Do you want me to give you a few minutes to do your hair?" And I said,
Oh, wow. That's funny.
I said, "Yeah, that'd be great." He goes, "Here, I got you a brush." So I got my hair
done. Oh, wow. And, you know, that's a good doctor.
Yeah.
He read your response. That was great.
Yeah, it was cool. It was really cool. And so that was a good way to bring back a memory for me. But great episode. And I think this is going to hit home to a lot of people.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate you, Angel Santana. Have faith, let it begin. Rod Freeman, Small Biz Up. Thanks for everything you're doing for us, Rod. We're going to need you as I said, changing the format of the podcast, going to get a little more informal, a less module based and a little more free flowing to let the energy between Angel and I flow like the lightning from the fingers of the Ultrons or whatever cartoons and Marvel world you watch. Want to also thank Michael John, Benzea, Charlotte Larson for their support and belief in us, our board of directors who are always directing us, you know, telling us how we can make a better product for who? For you, for the cancer survivor. This is the time that we're going to do our Newt Rockne pep talk. We do it every week. You guys are an amazing group of patients. You are a great, an amazing group of humans. You've gotten hit on the head with this terrible diagnosis, and we get it. We get it as much as we can. And we are here to help you through that journey with these little podcast squirts that might give you a little insight on what they're thinking, what we're thinking about on the other side of the curtain, what your doctors and nurses are thinking, why sometimes you have a bad experience with a doctor or a nurse, and how they feel afterwards. Sometimes I hope, maybe always, they feel badly like I do. If they do make a mistake and they're able to make amends and make changes and adjustments to make themselves better. And we want to make ourselves better, not for us. We want to make ourselves better for you guys because you guys deserve it. You guys deserve those four things. You deserve a safe environment. You deserve a trusting environment. You deserve a respectful environment. And you deserve a comfortable environment. And you should be able to get that, even with all of the things we're trying to do for you, by engendering informality, encouraging approachability, disseminating information, and demanding accessibility. So we should be able to be everything for you guys. And we always end each podcast the same. On behalf of Angel and the board of directors, we wish you all a long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. God bless you. God be with you. Peace.